Hello, Namaskar. This is Kaushiki Chakraborty. I am an Indian classical vocalist, composer, and performer. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, Trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a conversation with Indian classical music artist Kaushiki Chakraborty. Stay tuned. Once again, a heartfelt thanks to you for listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing and sharing it with your friends, and for following along, of course, on social media. If you're enjoying these episodes, by the way, please take a moment to submit a rating and a review, as it's truly appreciated. So it's not always obvious, but with art, and especially music, there is a great duality of dynamism and stillness. And I found that the masters, of course, seem to live and create and perform with a great synchrony and integration of this dynamism and stillness. Now, as a fan of Indian classical music, it's a true joy to see this on stage and experience or listen intently or even casually, especially when the product is simply a pure expression of the authenticity of the artist. And this is probably how many listeners and admirers would describe master vocalist Kaushiki Chakraborty. Kaushiki has been a devoted student and exponent of Indian classical music since she was a child, and she's been showcasing this exact authenticity on a journey of ongoing mastery for many years now, with a devotion and truth to her craft and her art. Her guru is her father, classical Indian vocalist Pandit Ajoy Chakraborty, and Kaushiki accompanied him on tours as a child and performed her first solo concert when she was just 16. She's also trained in Carnatic classical music from Pandit M. Balamurli Krishna, which amazingly has ensured for her an equal command over the various vocal forms that fall under that umbrella of classical Indian music. Kaushiki is a steward of the Patiala Gharana and has widely been considered as a generational master vocalist. Her incredible khayal performances are foundational, and her expressions through tumri, dadra, and bhajan offer a true range across the genre. Her performances have been described as a careful blend of lilt and force, powerful and supersonic, yet sweet and soothing. On top of that, Kaushiki's depth and command and creativity as a versatile musician and composer are showcased by her numerous projects with films, contemporary and popular music performances, and collaborations. And I was lucky enough to catch up with her after a recent US and European tour to chat about it all, from reverence and optimism to the joy of being a parent and teaching music to her own son. But we started with a very specific July in India topic about classical music and singing in the rainy monsoon season.
Rainy seasons are, especially from the Indian classical music tradition that I come from, there are many rags, there are many forms of tumri, which is like a kajri or a jhula, something like that. So they are all repertoire, they are all compositions and rags that are created, inspired by the monsoon. So for a country like India, monsoon is very important because, you know, after the scorching heat, it's finally little, nice cool breeze and a lot of rain.
Yeah.
And it also means a lot for the crops because it's a country which depends on its harvest. So from the ancient times, this was a time which was always celebrated from the very, very beginning of mankind trying to kind of grow their own crops and things like that. So this has been a very festive time, and music always have reflected the social sensibilities. You know, what the culture is celebrating, what the people are feeling, what the people are celebrating, the festivals, the seasons, the ceremonies, the rituals of our culture.
Yeah.
So when we as musicians, we go back to the repertoire that talks great deal about monsoon, I think we also see a monsoon which is beyond the urban monsoon that we see all around us through the music. Yeah. So I think through the music we see open fields, greenery, and, you know, the crops being grown, and, you know, people, you know, the farmers, their smiles and their happiness and their sense of fulfillment in this time. So I think we people who've been born and brought up in the cities, I think through our compositions, we see an India which is beyond the urban India that's all around us. So I think all these emotions and these traditions and these stories, because every song is a story. So these stories, I think it also takes us back in the history, tells us about the legacy of this country, tells us about the sensibilities of the people of this country. And I think it's beautiful to, you know, when it's raining outside, it's beautiful to sit inside the room and see the rain and sing a melody which is connected to that nature. Though I would not say that it's very tangible, the connection. I wouldn't say that I exactly know how the thunder is connected to Mia Malhar, how the how the rain is connected to Megh, how the lightning is connected to Surdasi Malhar. I wouldn't say that's very tangible. It's very abstract.
Yeah.
But I think it's also a lot of conditioning, and that is in our genes, because we have grown up with these sensibilities, and I think we have come to believe this as a part of our genetic coding. Maybe it has gone into our deep inside our genetic coding that we feel the connection between the melody and the nature.
And is there something just simply unique about classical Indian music that almost makes it belong in a season like the rainy season, or synchronize very easily with different seasons, as you mentioned already, that, you know, it's embedded in the cycle of things. And but particularly the nature of classical Indian music almost lends itself to be so appropriate for so many different moods. It has so many different textures and temperatures to it.
Correct. I agree. The two traditional forms of music from India, the ancient traditional forms of music, the very authentic Indian forms of music, are the Indian folk music and Indian classical music. I think both of them have been inspired by nature great deal.
Yeah.
So the content of this music, the sensibilities of this music, the emotion of these two forms of music have always been either about the absolute, whatever name you give it. You call it God, you call it Allah, you call it Ishwar, you call it whatever. Because from a country like ours, there's absolutely no demarcation that, you know, where one form of God ends and where the other form of God starts. I think it's all mingled and all, you know, it's all intertwined together into the culture of people. It's not only religion, it's also culture. Because, you know, Sri Krishna is a lover for us. Shri Ram is a husband for us. So, you know, it's not only religion. They're not only gods. They're like our own people. So, and we've grown up like that. So, the consideration of the absolute and the consideration of nature, which is another side of the absolute, another expression of the absolute. I think these two have been the primary and the fundamental source of inspiration for Indian folk music and Indian classical music. Or some rituals which is either about the gods, which is some puja, some celebration, some festival, or it is about the people. When it is about the people, it can be, you know, a Holi that we celebrate, the festival of color that we celebrate. It can be Jhula, which nowadays is not even celebrated. It's only because of the classical music repertoire that we know about Jhula. We don't celebrate Jhula anymore. But these festivals and cultures are like, you know, music is where they found their expression. And music is how we can go back to those festivals and how we can go back to those rituals. So music has been that pathway through which we can kind of go back in time and revisit those emotions and feelings and celebrations and festivals and change in nature and seasons. That is why what spring is now, we hardly see, you know, spring and hardly remember and remind ourselves of the natural, you know, the nature's element that changes around spring. But through these songs, we go closer to the feeling of a connection between ourselves and nature.
I wanted to ask you, you know, in that way, does thinking of this, whether it's a spirituality and a culture or even the natural surroundings around you, does it automatically make you a more optimistic person because you're almost reminding yourself of natural beauty, of spiritual beauty, of cultural beauty?
Yeah, I would think that not only Indian classical musicians, I think any creative art person who's creative at heart is very optimistic, because you can't create unless you believe in the goodness of tomorrow. Otherwise, you're not even inspired to create anything because you don't believe in the beauty of tomorrow. So I think any creative person has to believe in the beauty of tomorrow and what the promises it holds. And thus, they are always positive and optimistic.
I wanted to ask, you just returned from touring in the US and Europe, and you know, this is not something that's brand new for you. If I recall correctly, that you had first toured the US when you were 14.
No, I was six. I first toured the US when I was six. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah. So the YouTube footage that goes around when I was like maybe three or four. That was in one of the houses of my father's friend. And then from there itself, the plan happened that, you know, Baba had a tour in the US. So they said that, you know, why don't you bring her? So that's how I went to US, me and my mother and my uncle and my dad. So we went to US first in 1986, 87, when I was 6 years old.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, so in the times that reminiscing both about when you were much younger and even thinking about the touring from a musical standpoint, what are some things about concerts and performances, maybe globally, that actually haven't changed even since then, that seem like they are foundational, and no matter what, they still are connections that even though times have changed, you know, we're all connected with our smartphones and YouTube and whatnot. But maybe what are some of the things that even from those times in the mid 80s and early 90s that actually haven't changed very much?
So I think it's a little different when I talk about, I mean, from my experience, personal experience, I would say it's a little different when I talk about US as opposed to when I talk about Europe. The US audience, the audience that I have majorly performed for, I think that audience has been mostly Indian.
Yeah.
Indians who have left India in their early 20s and, you know, now they have, you know, their second generation and they want to kind of continue the legacy of listening and appreciating Indian classical music and Indian traditional art. So that has been the majority of audience. So that is one thing that has not changed. I actually would be optimistic and say that, you know, maybe there will be times when there be more Americans coming for Indian classical music concerts, which is still not the majority. I'm not saying they don't come. They are coming much more than before, especially for Indian classical vocal music. I would talk about that because the changes that happened thanks to Pandit Ravi Shankar Ji, Ustad Zakir Hussain Ji, Ustad Ali Abu Khan Saab, and all those Pandit Sapan Chaudhary Ji, who have kind of pioneered this cross-cultural kind of communication and conversation. So that it started with them. So thanks to them, I think instrumental music reached the American audience much more than vocal music and long back.
Yeah.
But I think now vocal music is more kind of being listened to and being appreciated, which is a great sign. And I would look forward to a time when more Americans would take interest and come for vocal music concerts as well. It is sometimes said that because vocal music has a language barrier, they might not be able to relate to it. though I don't agree, because I think music is an independent language. You know, a couple of days back in Europe, I was listening to Argentinian and Portuguese fado, and I did not think that, you know, not understanding Portuguese was any kind of a hindrance with the connection that I felt with the music. So I don't agree with that. So that's one thing that has not changed. And I also think that in Europe, that was always a little different, because in Europe, maybe because the Indian community is smaller, or maybe some other reason, I don't know. But in Europe, I've always seen more Europeans coming for concerts. Mm. Even this time when I performed in Europe in one of the world music festivals, I was in a venue which was 100% almost, apart from 5-6 people, 10 people maybe who were Indians and Afghans. Some of them were Afghans. So apart from that, most of them were German. So the concert was in Germany, Hamburg, and, you know, the entire audience was German audience. So even English is like an alien language to them. So it was extremely inspiring, challenging. I was nervous. I didn't know how to kind of connect with them, what they would connect with, what they would find interesting in this music, how would this expression relate to them. All that was very challenging, but I think I really, really enjoyed that concert. At the end of it, you know, their expression, their feedback, and their appreciation was very genuine, very heartfelt. But yes, things are changing for more positive. And what remains constant is their love for music, and is their bonding that sometimes is from their early childhood, which started from India. And sometimes in some of the families, now I see many of them, that kids who are like, you know, high school, college kids who are born and brought up in US, they are finding it so much interesting to listen to Indian classical music, Indian classical vocal music. I see so many of them, you know, come to concerts and also bring their parents to concerts, because they must have heard me or someone else on YouTube, on some digital platform somewhere, internet, and then, you know, they found this interesting and they want to come for concerts, and they're repeatedly, like, they are becoming regular audiences in US. And some of the things that have changed and were obvious to change were that, you know, that people are doing many more, you know, experiments, fusions. I mean, I don't like to say this word a lot, because it has been used and overused and misused. So I would say collaborations and newer ideas you know, exchange of ideas. So that is one thing that is happening much more than ever before, which is obvious, because, you know, that's how, you know, it's like conversation. It is ought to happen.
Yeah.
And from the audience side, I think, you know, the exposure to Indian music in anywhere in the world, that has become much more accessible. So there's a larger audience who are getting to listen to this music in their own comfort space. And because I understand it's an acquired taste. I wouldn't have, you know, liked or appreciated Indian classical music just like that if I was suddenly exposed to it in my 20s or 30s. I would have thought, I don't follow what's happening, and I don't understand the process. Right. I don't know how it unfolds. So it is an acquired taste. It needs a certain kind of a sanskar. It also is best when it is in the culture of the family. If it is heard anyway at home, if parents listen to it, and as a child, your subconscious kind of gets oriented to this kind of a sound, which is the best way to introduce Indian classical music to kids.
Yeah, because you know, in that same idea of learning or being exposed to the music as a child, what do you perhaps miss about being a student of music as a child? In now, like, reflecting back down on that.
Mm-hmm. And so there are things that I would say has two sides. Every coin has two sides. I would think that, you know, being a student of music, and more being coming from a family of musicians who are, you know, already celebrated and already very, very successful and legendary in their own rights. The pressure, the very latent pressure of, being seen all the time and being, you know, under vigilance all the time is something that I've grown up with. And I realized it much later, because when you grow up with something, you think that's the only way of life, and you never realize what kind of a pressure it is. And then later on you realize, okay, I could have had a very free kind of childhood where with no pressure, yeah. no expectations, nobody watching me, nobody expecting anything out of me. There's no benchmark set for me. I don't have to meet certain expectations. So that is something that I have never had. So I don't know yeah. how that childhood feels.
Yeah.
And but of course, I mean, because of that discipline and because of that kind of brought up and because of that kind of a family background, I was introduced to music so early in life. I had my guru at my home, which is the best yeah. thing. And, you know, I did not have to waste any time practicing anything wrong because I was corrected right at that moment, either by my mother
That's
or
true.
My father or my grandparents. Yeah. Because everyone was in music in some way or the other.
Do you miss that, by the way? Do you miss that constant sort of feedback and in some ways it being in that environment to some degree, as opposed to now when you don't necessarily have that kind of feedback all the time?
But I think, you know, when you grow up, when the first 25 years of your life, you grow up with that kind of feedback, I think it becomes a part of yourself. You don't need that beyond a point.
Mm.
You're constantly, now I don't have to go to someone else for that feedback. I have sure. those benchmarks set within me. So I can go to myself and, you know, I'm constantly getting feedbacks from my own self because those do's and don'ts, rights and wrongs and nuances of understanding and having a clarity about music that helps you grow. I think beyond a point when you live so many years with those judgments, assessments, feedbacks, those kind of discussions from where, you know, the way sometimes emerges, the way forward sometimes emerges.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Indian classical music artist Kaushiki Chakraborty. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello, I am Odissi dance artist Bijoyini Satpathy, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Indian classical music artist Kaushiki Chakraborty. In that same spirit, do you remember your very first solo concert?
Yeah, of course. I do.
I'm curious how you felt just before you went on stage that day.
Yeah, I was numb, absolutely numb. I was scared. I was 16. It was in Delhi
yeah.
at the India Habitat Center. I was a Sangeet Research Academy scholar at that time, so it was my solo performance. Then Ustad Zakir Hussain with Ustad Sultan Khan Saab. And both of them were backstage listening to me, sitting by the side of the stage with two chairs. Sitting there listening to me. In the auditorium, there was Amjad Ali Khan Saab and, you know, Asad Ali Khan Saab and Alarha Khan Saab and everyone, like all the legends and the gods and the absolutes that we have always, you know, we've grown up worshipping.
Sure,
they were all
sure.
there in Delhi. And Vijay Kichluji, who was the director of Sangeet Research Academy at that time, he had invited all of them. So, you know, in the dance tradition, you have the Arangetram, which is like the yeah. first performance where, you know, musicians, seniors are invited and this kind of small girl or boy is introduced to them. So this was my official kind of Hindustani music Arangetram, if it means anything, I mean, if it at all makes sense.
It does.
So it was like that. So all of them were invited so that they can listen to me and see if I'm good enough to be, you know, to be continuing and pursuing this tradition and if I'm going in the right direction. So Baba was playing harmonium with me. Pandit Samar Sahaji was playing tabla with me. I was wearing a peach reddish dress, shalwar. I remember everything.
Yeah.
Before the concert started, Baba asked me to go and touch feet of everyone. So I remember coming down the stage and the entire first row, man, I touched feet of everyone, like one after the other. And by the time I came back and Baba asked me to start the performance, I was totally out of breath. So I remember I sang Kedar and a Kamaj Thumri. So all details, everything.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious, as you think and reflect on that first concert, and now given the career, amazing career, as it's evolved and as it's developed, how now do you look at things like practice or preparation for your performances? Do you actually now prepare any differently than when you did for that first concert? Do you find it, by the way, easier to take risks when you're performing now as compared to then?
Your first question was that, do I prepare myself differently? Yes, very, very differently.
Yeah.
Before that first concert, or I would say first few years of each and every concert that I sang, my preparation was more skill-based. My preparation was like planning it. Like, you know, this is what I want to sing and these are the elements that I want to bring in somewhere in the performance, and this is something that I have worked hard on, and you know, I've worked on this taan, I've worked on this tihai, I've worked on this bandesh and this lay and that technicalities of maybe a thumri or a harkat or something that I must have been practicing around that time. I would plan it out. I would think, okay, these are the things that will come somewhere in the performance, and I would kind of design the performance in a way. But I think now I go on stage blank. I don't plan anything. I don't, maybe not preparing is the preparation now, because I think I...
Sure.
Honestly speaking, I think I prepare myself more spiritually than technically now. So that's very different.
Yeah.
That's very liberating. That's very relaxing, as opposed to how it felt before. Because after a performance, I would feel relaxed, and now before a performance, I would feel relaxed, and after the performance, I would feel energized.
Interesting.
A lot has changed.
Well, and so does that liberation, that relaxation, allow you to explore and find new dimensions, and particularly pushing boundaries and taking risks with your performances and with your music?
I think, you know, anybody, if you ask me, I would think I'm talking on behalf of everyone, but I think it's safe to talk for myself first.
Yeah.
Any creative person, any creative process, we do not ever take risks consciously. We don't think that, okay, now I will take a risk. It's never like that. I think we just go with the flow, and we believe in the truths of the moment, and whatever happens in that moment, we are happy to be with that process. We neither hold back nor we over-exaggerate it consciously in our minds, thinking that, okay, this is my taking the risk point and I will do it.
Yeah.
It's never like that. We don't take risks deliberately. It's not a deliberate risk-taking process. It's a conscious process of letting go. I mean, how much ever paradoxical it sounds, but it's a very conscious process of letting go of myself, letting go of the I, and stepping back, and let the process and let the truth and honesty and the purity of that, the authenticity of that moment, take over.
Can I ask you a follow up to that? In that way, has that approach also helped manage and balance becoming more versatile? And again, exploring more types of musical expression.
Yeah, absolutely. When you let go, I think you're less scared of taking risks, less scared of just being yourself. So I think in the process of music, the ultimate happiness and bliss lies in the state of mind where we are totally comfortable being ourselves, whatever that means.
Well, and as you attain more and more of that bliss, that comfort of being yourself and you become that much more versatile, does becoming more versatile and expressive ever come at the cost of perfecting and mastering the art form that you have studied with so much rigor?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Because a comfortable person is a very secure person. An insecure person can never be comfortable. And for you to have that comfort in music, the premise is that you would have done hours and years of hard work to achieve that comfort that allows you to be yourself.
Yeah. So if you think about that also, I wonder, I'm curious, is there a misconception then that other forms of music that you might express yourself through that are not classical music, that the perception might be that those styles take less rigor, meaning singing a bhajan or singing a light classical composition or even a pop style song might actually be simpler or easier, when in fact you have practiced and gained so much rigor and so much talent to perfect the art that it now is coming through as a different expression. And yet some people might think that it's just, well, it's easier to sing a different type of style.
No, it's not. It's totally wrong. It's totally a misconception, because I've tried singing for movies. I've tried singing for some collaborations. I've tried singing for some cross-cultural projects. I've tried collaborating with different kinds of musicians. And each time I had to learn something to be able to do it. It's not easy.
Yeah.
And doing one kind of music, whatever kind that may be, doing one kind of music doesn't make it easy for anyone to do the other kind of music. But having said that, I will add one thing, that when you have learned a discipline with so much sincerity, so much hard work, so much attention, so much involvement, that actually teaches you how to learn something else. Because you have basically learned how to learn. If you have not learned anything following a very rigorous discipline, then you haven't learned how to learn anything. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that is what learning Indian classical music has taught me, how to learn something else. So which means how to decode another kind of music, how to analyze and how to find the elements that actually essentially is that kind of music. For that, sometimes I have to undo some of my conditionings. I have to somehow sometimes express a line in a way that a classical musician will not. But that's also learning. And learning that has also been taught to me by the discipline of learning classical music.
Sure, sure. I've always wondered this about classical Indian musicians, whether they are performing as instrumentalists or vocalists. But the structure and rigor of the discipline and the beauty of that expression comes out so mathematically. Do you ever think in mathematical terms? Were you a good student of maths?
I was bad at maths. I was really bad. After my 10th, the first sentence was, I will never do maths again. I was really bad at maths.
And yet there's something so mathematical about music, right?
Yeah, people say that. And people say, my rhythmic expressions are so nice. I must have been a great math student. I'm not. I was never. I was never good at maths. I never liked that subject. But I understand that the scheme of it is very organized. And sometimes when something is very, very schematic, something is very organized, it seems like it's mathematics, but nature is so nicely organized. Nature is so diverse, yet it's so beautifully organized. And if this organization and this planning goes little bit here and there, we go haywire. Mm. But it's not mathematics, it's creation. And I also think that if you go very, very deep into mathematics, it takes you somewhere which is not only scheme, which is possibility.
True. Yeah, which is almost artistic in its own way.
Absolutely.
I had another question for you. How often do you dream about music?
Always. 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 I have so many dreams that I really don't think that, you know, I don't know whether even half of them can come true. But I dream about music all the time.
Yeah.
And when I say about music, not only me singing certain kinds of music, it's also listening to certain kind of music, enjoying certain kind of music, being able to learn certain kind of music, all that taken together. I dream about music in every possible way, as a student, as a performer, as an audience, as a listener, as someone who can, I think every dream of mine has, somewhere or the other, has music in it.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with Indian classical music artist Kaushiki Chakraborty. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, this is Madhuri Dixit, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation with Indian classical music artist Kaushiki Chakraborty.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit. You know, we just celebrated Guru Purnima, and
yes.
both Hindustani and Carnatic classical music is so steeped with tradition and
yes.
such a rich history. I wanted to know how reverence and respect. You mentioned your first performance where you went and touched the feet of many of the audience members. You know, how much does reverence and respect for gurus and teachers and tradition and even the style of a gharana, how much does that reverence actually help you to be innovative and in fact bring new discoveries to that tradition and create some, in some ways, new traditions as well?
See, it's a very interesting question, and I think my answer will be a little unorthodox because I was thinking about it the other day.
Yeah.
On the day of Guru Purnima, we were, you know, me and my husband, we were having diverse conversations about, you know, who's a guru, what is a guru, is it necessarily
right.
a person, is it something else, is it an energy, is it a mind space? A lot of things we were discussing, just, you know, in
sure.
general. And I think something very interesting came out of that, you know, when you think that you respect something, you actually find yourself to be very small in front of that. It's like a perspective ratio. So the bigger the respect is, the smaller you find yourself. But at the same time, you are expected to be creative. And for you to be creative and innovative, you have to have a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
And when you think of
yeah.
yourself as very small, you might sometimes lose that confidence.
Sure.
You might think that I'm totally so insignificant that how can I even create something? So I will keep on repeating something. And it has
yeah.
happened. It continues to happen with so many students that, you know, I would say that it's a misunderstanding of the idea of reverence towards your guru, because your guru wouldn't be the happiest person if he as a guru or she as a guru has not been able to make you as a student creative and innovative, because that's what
yeah.
he is aiming for. That's what the guru
yeah.
is trying. So I think it's a process that starts with respecting your guru, the person, the human being, which is very tangible, which is very,
yeah.
you know, concrete, like one person. And then it shifts to, you know, it doesn't shift, like it doesn't cease to be, you know, you don't cease to respect your guru, but it just then expands to respecting the craft,
yeah.
the space of music, you know, for specifically for me. Then it goes further. And then it involves all the musical legacies that has enriched that craft. So you respect that. And that this is where, you know, it starts with a gharana, where it's not only your guru, but other musicians of the gharana. And then it goes beyond your gharana. It goes beyond that, you know, periphery of only Patiala gharana. And then you start realizing how Patiala gharana must have been influenced by Jaipur style, by Gwalior style, by Kirana style. And then you start listening to these maestros of different gharanas. And you start, your reverence grows for them because you see the connection.
Yeah.
And you see the diversity, yet you see the common, you know, vibration of the source where the where all the imagination is coming out of. And then I think there comes a point where you start respecting the source within yourself from where all these stems out. And that is when you start feeling confident. That is when you start feeling that if I connect to that source, which is within myself, which is not tangible, which is nobody external, which I can't touch and hold and smell and can kind of grasp with my five senses. But there's another sense that tells you and gives you so much conviction that the seed for all this is within you. And it's very abstract. Mm. It's very vulnerable. It needs a lot of care and, you know, passion and pampering and love. And then when you start respecting that source within you, I think that is when you are confident to become creative and innovative.
I'm hearing you say all of this, and I can't help but wonder whether or not, as you talk about this sixth sense, this trust, if you will, this idea of love and passion for the art, in, you know, becoming that innovator and respecting what your guru has taught you, I'm so curious whether parenting has influenced at all, because of your unique experience in growing up in a musical household and now being an exponent and ambassador of that, whether or not parenting has influenced your own skills as a teacher, as a performer, and for that matter, vice versa, your skills as a teacher and as a musician influencing your abilities as a parent?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's very both way. It's absolutely both ways. And I think when we all would agree that, you know, our parents have had their own ways of bringing us up, and we have sometimes very, very our different ways of, you know, bringing up, you know, our kids. And in my case, I would say that it was obvious that it'll be different because my father was my guru, and in this case my child is my student and I am a mother. So, you know, a mother, the equation between a child and a mother can never be, you know, equated with anything else, be it a father, be it anybody else. So it's, I would be a little biased about that. So
super unique.
Super unique. It is super unique. And then one very, very significant layer of being a teacher added to that. I think it makes it very complex. It makes it supremely special for both of us. And it also makes it very, you know, multi-layered. So I think that way, I as a teacher and I as a mother, I think my son's journey of getting to know how this respect feels starts with me. But at the same time, because I'm the mother, I think that respect is always inside. But what is apparent is the love. So the respect is as if the respect is so much kind of covered with so much love, where the respect is very nicely protected. But what you feel every day is love. So, you know, on a Guru Purnima day, you know, my child would come and give me a tight hug and say, you know, happy Guru Purnima, this is such a lovely day. So that's, I wouldn't ever do that to my dad.
It is a different experience.
It is very different. And it is not very different by default. It is very different because we've from the day one, me and Partho, we've we've worked towards, you know, making it very different so that...
Quite by design, quite by intention.
Quite by intention, because respect with so much reverence sometimes brings a distance.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you know, somebody you respect is up there and you can never reach there. But love is such a unifying principle. It's such a beautiful emotion, which kind of embraces everything and takes care of everything and feels for everything, yet, you know, never takes it easy. And there's no distance. You're like, you're an extension of your guru. You're not, your guru is not up there and you're not down here. So when the mother and the father and the parents and the closest people in today's time, because today is a very different time from the time that we were children. So, and in today's time, a child who is pursuing Indian classical music, who is wanting to learn Indian classical music, is anyway, it's not the majority in the society. Not many people in his school and college would do this. And then on top of that, if we burden him with the reverence, with the distance, with the format and structure of how we were brought up, then it will even isolate him from us.
Of course.
And then between us and him, there will be no possible conversation that can bond us together as a family and in terms of music. So for music to flow, for relationships to flourish, for love to happen, and for this beautiful gift of craft to find its expression, I think it's very important to somehow prioritize love over respect.
And I love how you put that there's, it's a very different, in many ways, expression of that love, especially when you're a parent.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Kaushiki Chakraborty.
Hello, I'm Ahilya Bamru. I am an actor, a content creator, singer, and writer. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Indian classical music artist, Kaushiki Chakraborty.
When you think about the state of classical Indian music, not only is reverence at play, but certainly we always need to talk about relevance. And in thinking of Indian classical music, especially in such a digital era, where, you know, we even think about AI and artificial intelligence and how things get replicated. How does an art form like Indian classical music stay vibrant and stay even commercially successful to be relevant when someone like you, who's such an ambassador of the art and the music, thinks about this? How do you think this kind of art form stays relevant in today's times and in the future, for that matter?
Yeah, I think there are certain changes that had to be made, and I think they are changing in a very positive direction. I think I have just, you know, I was talking about one of those very key factors, which is approaching classical music. Approaching classical music has always been like, you know, this is not my cup of tea kind of a thing for the younger generation. Yeah. But now... Yeah. Thanks to, you know, our generation of musicians and how we present music and how we are as people and how we, thanks to social media and all, how we are as people beyond the musician. I think that has become much more relatable for the younger generation. So they know that, you know, I backpack as well. I go for solo trips. I cook and I bake and I go on stage and I sing. So I'm just a normal person. I'm not, you know, for the earlier generations, you know, I'm sure they would have thought that, you know, they come from Venus and perform and go back to Mars, something like that.
Right.
So they were from different planets. They used different vocabulary. They talked in a different, in a language that not always the younger generation would have related. But now things are very different. So that is making Indian classical music more relatable and accessible to younger generation. And, you know, it is becoming as if we can approach the musicians and we can talk to them about their music. And we can also ask them that, you know, what is it that you enjoy? And they have something to say and we can have a conversation. So there's a communication that can be established between people who are seriously practicing this and people who are trying to understand what it is. So that is, I think, is bridging the gap between people who are into it and people who are not, which is a great sign. And following that path and that bridge, I think a lot of youngsters are taking Indian classical music more, in a more friendly way. And thanks to the digital space, thanks to the internet, I think independent music has a very, very strong foothold at the moment coming from India. You know, the only kind of popular Indian music that we heard as children were film music. But now there's so many other kinds of music, so many, you know, YouTube channels, so many, you know, playlists on your Spotify and iTunes and everything. So it is making it more, its presence is more felt in the popular mediums. So, and there, because it is more there, I think there are more opportunities for youngsters to create something on their own. And you don't have to go to a company like a HMV to say that, you know, I have sung three songs, can you please release an album? And, you know, give them your demo cassettes and things like that. That is not the thing. So you can have your own YouTube channel, which is your own reality show. You can sing whatever you want to sing. And because these platforms are growing consistently, yes, maybe not all of them are, you know, virals, but yes, there are many, many such platforms which are run by individual musicians who as yet don't even have a big hit song or something like that. But because they are consistently putting out stuff, they have an audience which is growing and they are also collaborating amongst themselves. So they're creating different kinds of music. So different platforms are merging, different audiences are getting to listen to each other's music. And because creative music and creative expression is finding its platform, I think learning Indian classical music is becoming more relevant. Because if you have to create, you have to learn the tradition of this country's music. Because if you have to sing one line in three different ways, you have to learn how to create these, the extra two different ways that the composition doesn't give you. Yeah. So to improvise, you have to learn. Even if you want to improvise a film song and make a cover, if you want to sing that one line in two different ways, you have to learn how to kind of move around that rag or that scale or that melody and create newer possibilities. For that, you have to learn. So now people are coming and learning more because they want to create their own music.
What do you say to the notion, you know, in some ways I can think of it differently. What perhaps of all of this that you mentioned, what can't be duplicated by AI?
The creative factor cannot be duplicated by AI because you rightly said what can be duplicated. Creation cannot be duplicated. Mm. It's repetition.
Yeah.
So I think few of the things that is beyond the capacity of AI is creative art.
Yeah, sure.
Because a human creation and that human being's conditioning, that human being's history of learning a certain kind of a sensibility and the sensitivity of expression, that cannot be totally duplicated by AI ever. You know, if I sing 500 tans, that can go to AI as an input and it can create the 501 and the 502 tans. But then I can always create another 500 tans, which will never be similar to these 500 tans, which can again go to the AI as inputs, but cannot come out of an AI as an output.
And it eliminates the surprise or even the spontaneity in some ways, I imagine, of the art itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So I think the more brave and secure and confident that we can be in our own creation, I think the more we are eliminating the possibility of duplication. Because if we are creating out of an insecurity, if we are creating out of a desperation, then that is not spontaneous creativity.
Of course. Koshikiji, I'm listening again to you speak so elegantly about the craft and the art. And I've read that your musical expression has been described to be a careful blend of lilt and force. Powerful and supersonic, yet very sweet. Do you think this is also a best description of you as a person?
Yes. I can only, the one thing that I'm very confident about at this time of my life is that I think finally I'm finding that comfort of being totally who I am in my music as I am as a person. And that always takes a lot of courage. That always takes a lot of, confidence and, you know, being comfortable with yourself so that you can express who you are through your music. Because you always start with certain formats, certain prototypes, and you want to match them for the longest time. And sometimes in the process of doing that, you sometimes go away from exactly who you are as a person. Mm. So I think I've been very, very fortunate, and I'm very grateful to the process that brought me to a place which gives me courage to be exactly who I am in my music. It's a very honest expression. Sometimes people say that, you know, there could be more silence in your music. Of course there could be. The day I become more silent as a person, my music will reflect that silence. But I am a very expressive person. So I want to express a lot. So my music, I think, sometimes expresses that.
Your talent is so superbly and globally known, and you've performed at venues and concerts in India and around the world, of course. Yet for those who might actually be listening to your music, maybe for the first time, how do you hope they feel after experiencing your music?
I hope they feel happy. Happy. Yeah, it's very important for me. Because I really want them to feel happy, feel bright, feel positive, and feel blissful. That's always my state of mind when I sing. And I hope it reflects in my music and it gets translated in my musical expression. And it has an impact in my audience's heart, that it makes them feel happy and positive and bright and energized. You know, we are all messengers of the craft. So I just hope that I'm sending out the right message, because beyond my life, the message will stay. And I realize the responsibility of that, and I understand and I remind myself of the responsibility more because I'm a mother now, because I exactly know how everything that I do and I believe and I express, how it stays beyond me and how it has an impact in lives which will be here beyond my life. So as a messenger of my craft, I realize the responsibility, and I just, you know, I seek blessings and good wishes from everyone.
Well, Koshikiji, I know that the energy that people are feeling when they're experiencing your music, the window into who you are and the mirror of who you are, is really being enthusiastic about the art and the craft and learning so much about you and really feeling very blissful. We're so grateful that you were able to spend some time with us. Koshikiji, thank you so much for all of your time, and I hope we can have this conversation again down the road.
Oh yeah, sure, definitely.
Thank you so much, Koshiki, and thank you all again for listening and sharing and rating and reviewing and spreading the word about Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.